1,104 days in Russian captivity.
They forcibly took me there, blindfolded me, pushed me to the ground, and said, well, shall we talk normally? People were forced to bury the bodies of their loved ones with their own hands. I lived with hope.
My name is Michael Duncan. Until 2022, I was living my best life. I worked in the media, implemented international projects, but the Russian invasion changed all that. I was at war, and have seen a lot. But one particular day, when I witnessed a prisoner exchange, it affected my life in an unexpected way. This podcast will tell the dramatic stories of Ukrainians who went through the harsh reality of Russian captivity. So, today's guest in my improvised studio is David Pradchenko. He is a Marine, a defender of the city of Mariupol. David spent 1,104 days in Russian captivity. So that's a very long time, 3 years. The first thing I want to ask you is how you feel after all this. How do you come to terms with the fact that 3 years of your life were spent in those extremely difficult conditions?
Hello, everyone. Well, how can this fact be explained? Look, I've just come to terms with it. Well, yes, in general, I spent my youth at war, from the age of 20 to 25. In the year 2020, I signed a contract and voluntarily went to war. And that's when I realized that I was already losing my youth, and now I've come to terms with it. Time has passed, and that's it.
By the way, how do you define it for yourself? Did you just lose it?
It was stolen. They took that time from me in Russian detention facilities where I faced abuse 3 years.
You know, it's a very long journey, but let's try to start from the beginning. Off camera, we talked about Mariupol, and there are a lot of insinuations, and both true and false information about this city. Based on your experience, what you saw, is the scale of the deaths reported in our media really true? Can it really be confirmed?
Yes, it can be confirmed, because there were many cases on the outskirts of the city and in the city itself. Civilians who had lost their lives during the Russian attacks lying on the roads. Then people buried their relatives themselves because there was nowhere else to bury them. Even if you wanted to go to the cemetery, it was almost impossible because there was shelling. So people had to bury the remains of their relatives in their yards. Sometimes locals would come to me. One woman said that her mother had died and had been in the apartment for over a week. She didn't know what to do with her because there was nowhere left to bury people.
These people, I mean, the ones who are still alive, the ones you talked to, were they people who supported Russia or people who supported Ukraine?
No, these were people who supported Ukraine. I was at my position and they would come up to me and offer me coffee. It actually was a bit shocking for me. They could give us water they had left or something else. Or, for example, they could cook us something to eat if we had any food for that. There was a case when a local woman just came to our position and said, let me cook you something to eat because you are standing here for days.
There is one more interesting point here. The Russians constantly say that they want to protect the Russian-speaking population. Mariupol, as far as I know, I haven't been there, unfortunately, but as far as I know, it was mainly a Russian-speaking city. Did they understand that a Russian-speaking family lived in that house, which we want to protect, but this family is Ukrainian-speaking, so we won't protect them?
No, they didn't understand. The shells were landing across many areas. The Russians didn't know where they were targeting, so people hid wherever they could. Most of the population there was Ukrainian. They were for Ukraine. They were pro-Ukraine. Unfortunately, there were also some who were pro-Russian. But then they saw what the Russian world was like. And now I don't know where they are.
Some of them are probably no longer with us.
Yes, they probably met the Apostle Peter.
Dark humor. By the way, I like that a person has spent 3 years in captivity, but still has a sense of humor. Off camera, we joke and talk so much that it's hard to believe we're about to have a conversation about captivity, torture, prisons, and so on. As far as I know, you tried to escape from Mariupol once, but unfortunately, it didn't work out. Tell us a little about that story, how you tried to escape.
I think, roughly, it seems to me, there were two attempts to break, maybe through between April 10 and 11. On the first attempt, we formed a convoy and drove towards Volnovakha. But then it became clear that we were being targeted, and all their guns were aimed at the road where we were.
Were you traveling in a convoy?
Yes, we were driving in a convoy. We set off, and after a while, our convoy came under heavy fire and suffered severe losses. When the shelling started, we were right under a bridge. I hid under the bridge, crawled under it, and sat there until the shelling ended. Then we tried to dig ourselves into the ground with another guy, using our automatic weapons. We also dragged a wounded tank driver there. His nickname was Sidi. We dragged him there because his ribs were broken. He dug with his feet, and we dug with our AK guns, so that if the bridge collapsed, we would at least stay alive. And suddenly, if there was a sweep, at least we could defend ourselves. We dug in there more or less. Well, and then I start looking around. Well, we're pretty much dug in there now, more or less. We went, found the fire station there, and went down into the basement. And also, the Russians saw us there anyway and began shelling the area with mortars.
before you ended up in the basement. You also mentioned that you tried to save a life.
Yes. When things calmed down a bit, we went to get all the wounded. We got as many wounded as we could. And also, well, there was... We went up the hill and seen that the field was just covered with the bodies of the fallen. Many of our people were killed there. And also, then I went down to the bridge and saw my friend, my brother in arms. I couldn't save him.
What was his name?
Andriy Soskida. He was a soldier in the 128th Mountain Assault Brigade. And he was lying there. He had two holes in his legs. I tried to save him, but he needed urgent medical evacuation. I didn't have the medicine I needed to save him.
Was he conscious?
Yes, he was still conscious, but then his pulse became weak, and that was it. I put on him my tourniquet, even though I shouldn't have done that. With his last breath, he told me to tell his mother, his daughters, all his relatives, that he loves them so much. I promised him I would.
Did you keep your promise?
Yes, that was one of my two main tasks that I had to complete when I returned from captivity. I constantly thought about how I could do it, and I kept thinking, well, what's the best way to do this? When I returned, a friend from my brigade wrote to me and asked if it was me in the photo from the prisoner exchange. I confirmed it. She asked if I knew what had happened to Andriy. I said that I did. I even contacted the coordination headquarters for the treatment of prisoners of war about this. I called the 128th Brigade and they said they didn't have any information. But then they found some and I called his wife. She couldn't believe me. She said she still doesn't believe it, even though they have already buried him. Well, it's me after all.
Did you only talk on the phone or did you see each other in person?
By phone. I haven't gone there yet. Although she asked me to come to her town to meet personally and talk. Well, I'll go there. She invited me, saying she'd be happy to see me.
It seems like this is just the beginning of your story, but it's already so dramatic that you could make a separate movie about it. So, from what I saw on your profile, you were in four prisons, right?
Yes.
Olenivka, Taganrog, Kamishi, and Pavkino.
Pavkino, yes.
Which of these prisons did you spend the most time in, and which did you spend the least time in?
Well, Olenivka was short. I was there only for 2 days. It's like a transit point. Then I was transferred to Taganrog. I went to Taganrog. I was there for about 2 days. I only spent the night there and went through the reception process called Priyamka, and then they took us straight to Kamishi. I stayed there for 6 months, and then in Pavkino for 2.5 years.
When you were transferred between these prisons, and what was your impression? When they tell you that you are being transferred to another prisons, is that a positive thing or a negative thing?
It's a negative thing, because you understand that if they are transferring you, it means another Priyamka, and reception means nothing but harsh physical treatment.
Okay. We will talk about Priyamka further, because it is an important attribute of any Russian prison. In your case, there were three prisons, and then a fourth where you were for a long time. Can we say that you get used to it, psychologically, to the place where you are?
And yet, you just get used to it.
Like, despite all the irritants around you, you still get used to it?
You still have to get used to all this, because you live here. You just realize that someday, your day will come, and you will be exchanged. Yes, you get used to it.
Okay, which of these prisons did you find the harshest to stay in?
The harshest is Kamishi. First of all, there's the Priyamka. Second, there is the bath. Third, there are the interrogations.
Okay, what do you mean by the bath?
Once a week, they took us to wash ourselves. For a few minutes, even seconds. 5 seconds to undress. They forced us to strip naked. They took us to a large room where there were taps. You turn on the cold water. You wash quickly, in about 5 seconds. And then you had to turn back. If someone didn't manage to get dressed in 5 seconds, they were rushed with a stun device. Then we stood in the Zhu position. It is also called swallow. Put your hands up, get on all fours, and wait for the command. If the command was to move on our right, then that was it, the end. That was good. It was physical abuse, electric shocks, whatever they wanted. But as long as there was no such command, they mocked us.
Is it really possible to get dressed in 5 seconds?
It's possible. If you have everything prepared, it's possible to jump right into your clothes.
So, basically, you have 20 seconds to run there, wash up, and return back.
Yes, impossible. But most of the time is taken up by their mockery.
Why do you think that is? Why is it set up that way?
Well, I think it's them. They're over there. Well, I think they all work according to the same method there. Because they had all kinds of courses there. That's what we heard. In addition, there are people working there who were bullied as children, and they came here to work. Well, you know, I'm sure that to boost their ego at our expense. At our expense, to raise him. And then this same person goes home to his family. He is considered a hero by his family for mocking Ukrainian prisoners of war.
Do you think his family knows about this?
I think so.
And they're okay with it?
And they're okay with that. I think they come home and just talk about how they abused someone that day. And their families call them heroes for that. That's definitely how it is.
So, on the one hand, it is state policy to treat Ukrainian prisoners this way. And on the other hand, society tolerates it. At least I think that's how it works.
Yes, yes.
Okay, what was your day in prison like in general? Well, let's imagine, for example, when you woke up there, what did you usually do? Regular schedule? For example, what do you do in the evening?
In the morning, you wake up, wash, and then do exercises. And after that, after exercising, you wait for breakfast. It's something like that. After breakfast, you wait for the guards to change shifts and check the prisoners by name. Then they lock the cells. After that, you go for a walk. After your walk, they take you back to your cell. You wait for lunch. After lunch, if you are sitting in your cell, you can read a book or walk around the cell. Although in the detention center we sat, we did not walk around the cell. We could only go to the toilet in turn. And also, then you wait for the doctor to come and check on you, but he might not come. Well, that's how it is. And then you wait for dinner, and after dinner you wait for lights out. It's something like that.
Okay. From what you've said, it certainly doesn't make it any easier for you, but I've talked to some of the guys, and they would be very happy to have such a schedule, to be honest. Because for them, everything you've described was accompanied by almost constant...
Oh, yes, I just didn't mention that. There are constant physical assaults. No, it's definitely.
Well, it's just important. Because the way you described it, it sounds like some kind of sanatorium, you know, where you eat, wash, but...
It's 100% regular abuse.
Well, okay. When could it happen?
Even when you're out for a walk. You go for a walk, you open your eyes a little, because they themselves told you to open your eyes a little. And in one moment, they just grab you and start abusing you for it.
Were there any interrogations? Some specific ones.
I was interrogated. More than once, it was in Kamishi, after the bathhouse. I hit the jackpot and went in for questioning. Well, basically, I'm walking in, and there's this, like, you know, a cage. And sitting there is a SWAT officer on guard. I was walking, and he looked at me and asked how I was feeling. I replied that I was fine. He said that things would get even better. I was surprised, but okay. So I went where he told me to go, namely to the basement. I stood by the wall, and they brought out a guy with a bag over his head. They forcibly took me there, blindfolded me, pushed me to the ground, and said, well, are we going to talk normally? I replied that we could talk normally. How many civilians have you killed? They ask me, but I haven't. Then they say, we see that you don't want to talk normally. They say, fine. Then attached an old telephone called a tapik to my fingers, specifically my little fingers. They also attached a tapik to my toes. They started turning it so that it would deliver electric shocks. Poured water on me, used a stun device, and struck my heels. And they kept asking how many civilians I had killed.
And there is no right answer.
No, there isn't.
Whatever you answer, it will continue? How long could it continue?
Oh, I don't know. I was there for about an hour, maybe even longer. I didn't count the time, but I endured it. I returned to my cell very exhausted. Well, you know how it is. You know, it's so extreme there that you don't keep track of how much time you've spent there. It's something like that.
Just, again, it's interesting that off the air we were talking, I asked you about the hardest period, and you said that it was in the hospital. Tell us a little about that.
That happened later in the hospital.
What happened there? Was there a reception priyomka at the hospital?
In the hospital, they tied me down, which was the worst part. I'm telling you, when I ended up in their hospital, in the city of Vladimir, I think. They have a clinic for prisoners there, and I had problems with my leg.
Was there no priyomka at the hospital?
Yes, there was.
That's so funny.
There was a priyomka there. So I got there, went through the reception, they took me to a cell, and I changed my clothes. And after that... Actually, they changed my clothes. I went into a cell that was meant for two people. And also, there was a toilet, everything inside. And I was already thinking that now I would lie down and rest. Yeah, sure, I'll lie down and rest. I lay down, and they tied me up like Jesus Christ, just by my hands and feet. They also put a medical mask over my head. So I couldn't see anything.
Over your eyes?
Yes, well, but I did it like that and just removed it so that I could at least see what was happening. Because you don't know what was going on around you, at least what time it was. At first, they even covered the window with a blanket so that we couldn't see and didn't know whether it was evening or daytime.
Why is that?
So that we would be disoriented, if I've spelled that word correctly.
Yes, but you're already in prison. What else can they take from you?
They were just putting psychological pressure on us. Plus, they were feeding us some kind of psychotropic drugs. They forced us to take some pills and checked to make sure we swallowed them. You have to show that you've swallowed them. Local prisoners brought it crushed, mixed, and gave it to us. This was so it would work faster. I drank and showed it. And so the other guy and I ended up in the hospital. They kept us tied up for a week, then untied us.
So you're tied up there the whole time?
They kept us tied up for a week, then untied us.
The first question was, how do you go to the toilet?
To go to the toilet, if I needed to take a leak, they untied one of my hands and I had to lie on my side and hold the container with one hand. Everything had to be done with one hand, holding the container and your genitals. After you finish, you put it back. The prison guard came, looked, poured out the contents, and that was it. If you needed to go number two, they untied us, and the prison guard stood and waited. We were allowed about 5 minutes, maybe less. We had to do it extremely quickly, then lay down, and they tied us up again. For eating, it would be the same. The guards waited and watched us.
And the doctors who were there, were they civilian doctors or Federal Penitentiary Service doctors?
They were FPS doctors, but actually they were both FPS and civilian doctors.
And they walked around and watched you tied to the bed and they were okay with that?
Yeah, and they don't care. It's normal for them.
Okay, what kept you from...
Have I lost my mind?
I wanted to say going nuts, but okay.
It is my family. When I was still in Mariupol, I asked my mom to take a family photo. He took a family photo, but unfortunately, it has not been preserved. I remembered it, and I lived with the fact that I had a family, and I lived with the hope that they were alive, and that everything was fine with them. That helped me a lot.
You know, you are like Dominic Toretto. Family is the most important thing there is. This is awesome.
For me, family is the most important thing.
And you kept that photo in your head all this time?
Yes. Even when I was being beaten, I understood and always remembered what my brother had told me. They will beat you. They will do other things to you. He said, cry, scream, but don't give up. That's all. When I got out, he met me and I repeated those words to him. And I told him that family photo remained in my memory. Even when they were beating me, I could see our family photo in front of my eyes. That's all.
Man, you're awesome. I understand that you can't relax in prison, you can't relax in the hospital. When could you get a little break?
You can laugh at them, you can even make jokes at some of the guards.
You probably have to do it very carefully.
It's very careful, only among prisoners. We gave all the guards nicknames. Guys in my cell and I, we give them nicknames by ourselves. When someone came on duty, we would say that it's that guy who had come on duty. We began to recognize them by their voices. And we already knew who was coming on duty, when and where.
I guess you could have had a little laugh at their expense here and there. Cheer yourself up, so to speak.
Yeah, let's put it that way.
But actually, the funniest story was the one about you, which made me laugh so hard. As I understand it, there was a Priyamka in Olenivka, and they asked you, glory to whom?
No, it wasn't Taganrog.
Please tell me about it.
It was in Taganrog. I had a reception. I went there, or rather, they brought me there. They stripped me and started assaulting me. And during the process, one of them started asking me, glory to whom? I replied, glory to Ukraine. He got so angry, started to shout, you bastard, and started assaulting me even more. I didn't know what to say.
And what did he want to hear?
We were used to greeting each other with glory to Ukraine and glory to the heroes.
I understand that he decided you were a tough nut to crack because you said glory to Ukraine, but you just didn't know what he wanted you to say.
I don't know what he wanted to hear. It was extremely violent. I just didn't know.
That's also very cool. Okay, let's move on to this story about the Priyamka. We've mentioned it a few times. Tell us, what is this procedure called Priyamka, or reception?
The first reception was in Olenivka, or Yelenovka. They brought us there in police vans. The van was designed for 6 people. They put 10 or 15 of us in there. One guy started screaming. He asked them to let him out because he couldn't breathe. The guard said he would let him out. Then the bars opened, they started reading out our names, and we started to get out, or rather jump out. Dogs were waiting for us there. Then we had to kneel in the courtyard. They checked us there. It was pretty unpleasant and didn't exactly thrill us. I ran out there and knelt down. I had a Ukrainian flag as a chevron. The guard came up to me and asked what it was. He said, is this yours? I said, yes, it's mine. He said, eat it. I said, I'm not going to eat that. He said, eat it, bitch. He started shoving it in my mouth and I had to eat it. Then you have to walk through the so-called corridor of life. The corridor of life is when special forces stand on both sides. There are all those who just want to harm you.
Were there a lot of them there?
Yes, there are many of them there.
20, or is it more?
Up to 20. You just have to go up from the first floor to the second. And they send you to this corridor of life. You go there and you just have to run through it quickly. During this, they just strike you with sticks, truncheons, or use stun devices. And I ran there, they hit me repeatedly there, and part of them met me the same way upstairs. Upstairs, we had to strip naked and stand there. They searched us to make sure we didn't have anything prohibited. They ordered us to take off our shoelaces. I took off my shoelaces, walked over and squatted down. He sat down there. He hit you a couple more times with his stick. Well, I sat down, put my hands behind my head, and squatted there waiting for everyone else.
And when you were passing through that, was there anyone who didn't make it, who was killed on the way?
Yes, there was a case when they fatally beat a man. Poor guy in the neighboring barracks had a heart attack and died during Priyamka.
Right during the reception? It is a harsh system. They certainly have a strict system.
Of course, the one in charge, Vladimir Vladimirovich. He said that those who defended Mariupol should learn what Russian captivity is like. And that's what the guards told us.
Time passes, you know, 4 years of war are behind us, and the Russians already know what Ukrainians are like.
Yes.
I think they no longer consider us a brotherly people, and that we are some kind of wild Russians here.
Yes, yes, yes.
Now they understand what Ukrainians are like. Okay, let's move on to the second part of the conversation. 1,104 days. You had a daily schedule where you were always doing something. Are there any sources of information in Russian prisons that you can use to find out what is happening outside?
Not in prison. They broadcast audio. They only have their radios.
What kind of radios are these?
There is kind of a speaker on the wall above, and from there, they turn on the radio via a flash drive so that the recording can be heard throughout the prison. They play it on a tape recorder or a flash drive. I never quite figured it out. They could turn on their children's Russian songs, Katyusha, some of their zombifying programs, especially this guy Patrick Lancaster.
Is he American?
An American, yes. He shouted that they were coming to liberate Ukraine from fascism, which in my opinion sounds quite interesting and strange in itself. We had already studied him. We had been hearing the same thing for over a year and a half, and we already knew what program was behind it. No, they made us listen to Patrick Lancaster.
Why Patrick Lancaster? They have Solovyov, Skabiva, others.
Because he's an American who became Russian, sort of. And he moved to Russia. He fled America. He's in Russia. He represents their media, the Russian media. And he kind of shows that Russia is doing the right thing.
Then we'll probably cut this out. But what a dick.
Yes.
Have you also encountered Americans in captivity?
In captivity, yes. And it happened. We heard and we know they took an American there, an old man over 70, somewhere around 75 years old. He's a civilian, but he was captured because he was walking near a Russian checkpoint with a laptop. He was trying to get internet access. Well, he wasn't very successful, of course. So they threw him in jail. Although he made life difficult for them there too, he didn't want to be treated and asked them to let his son visit him. He said that his son and he himself were not Ukrainians, they were from America. He talked to them about various things, told them a little bit about everything. Well, in the end, they gave him 7 years in prison.
Do you remember his name?
No, I don't, unfortunately.
But look, one American says that Russia is liberating people, while another is sitting in prison because Russia captured him.
No, we didn't believe it.
It's like expectations and reality as they are. And by the way, how did you perceive the fact that Lancaster or someone else was saying something through this radio? You saw reality and then they dumped some information on you. Did you believe any of it at all?
We didn't believe it. We didn't believe that. They were walking around and shouting in their courtyards, those guards. Our windows were open and they were walking around shouting that they had taken Kyiv and so on. Well, our guys, among our small group, were saying that they can occupy Kyiv only in their wet dreams. They tried to convince us of all these lies, but we didn't believe them.
Oh, by the way, I forgot to ask about the American. Did the guards or raiders express their views on the USA, like what or who is US to them?
Yes, they are fighting, as we were told. They are not fighting against Ukraine, they are fighting against the West. That is USA.
Okay, so for them, the USA is the enemy. But Patrick Lancaster is a friend to them?
Yes, impossible.
So they talked about the West. That they are fighting the West, but was there any specificity that there is US and there is EU, like something else about Europe?
Not. They said, now I remember these words. Don't carry out the orders of the West, like it's some kind of order from the West, like the orders of America. You are like our brotherly people, we are brotherly nations. You must not carry out the orders of the West.
Well, they have a lot of these, like, dissonances, in fact, and controversies in their society because of the way propaganda is pumped up there. And what did he want to hear? And one of these points, by the way, is that I hear a lot abroad too. I communicate with people, and sometimes I hear the narrative that Russians say, like, we are the cradle of Christianity there, or we are the cradle of Orthodox Christianity, traditional values, traditional family. Like, for someone who doesn't live next to Russia, this might seem plausible, but for someone who has been inside, like you, for example, do you consider yourself a Christian at all? What do you think about that? Tell us, please. Or do you not belong to any religion?
I personally believe in myself here. Faith lives within me. I don't go anywhere, like to a church, maybe like when Easter is coming, and that's it.
Okay, were there guys there who considered themselves Christians, like, and, well, somehow could show it?
You see, all you can do is put your trust in the Lord God. You believe. Well, we managed to get into the prayer room. They took us there to this little room where you could go to pray. There was a Bible there. Well, Russian, of course. You could pray there. I had a cross that they gave us to carry in our pockets. But I made a string out of a blanket and hung it around my neck. During inspections, I had to take it off and put it in my pocket.
But, well, the guards themselves, they are also, well, Orthodox Christians. Was there, well, any place for some Christian mercy towards you?
No, there isn't. They don't have any.
It didn't play a role at all?
No, it doesn't at all.
I've been swearing up a storm in my head, but I don't want to say it out loud. Okay. Was there a difference in the attitude towards you and the convicts who committed some crimes there on the territory of Russia? Because I understand that you were staying together with the convicts or not.
No, we sat separately, but the convicts watched us there. The one who brought food was called a balandior. Palamoika, as we called another one, washed our corridors. There were also convicts who repaired things when necessary. A leaky faucet or something else. The guards were more aggressive towards us than towards the convicts. Well, I think it's them. The convicts felt like they were serving their time there. Yes, they were behind a fence, but they could walk around the territory. But in the hospital, they treated their own and us the same. At least that's how I saw it, based on my observations. They could swear, curse, and even assault one of their own. In short, they were treated the same way as us. It depends on where you end up and how they treat you there. There are concepts such as red prison, black prison, or blue prison, something like that.
Well, because again, communicating with other guys who were captured, I at least drew this pattern for myself, that in principle, our prisoners are usually treated worse than those who are, conditionally, rapists, murderers, but they are simply Russians. So it turns out that based on national characteristics, they determine who to treat worse, who to treat better.
Yes, yes.
Because, after all, you didn't commit any crime against Russia, you were defending your own state.
That's how it is.
Well, let's imagine, for example, these guards, they, well, treated you like this because they had orders from above to do that, or did they just like it? What do you think about that?
It depends on the specific guards. They had orders. Our guys sometimes heard what was being said in the smoking room, and that's how they overheard the guards' conversation. One of them said that we needed to be punished for something, and another objected, saying, "Why should we do that? The prisoners already know everything and are sitting quietly, not breaking any rules." Another guard replied that they had been told to do so, that they had orders.
And if we talk about the percentage of adequate and inadequate guards?
More unstable. I think roughly...
Is it more like 60 to 40 or 80 to 20?
80 to 20. I would even say 90 to 10. There are many more unstable guards there.
Tell me a little about who was sitting with you. Well, serving their sentence, to be more precise. And like... Who do you remember? You said that the mayor of Kherson was there, some American grandpa.
Once a month, our cells could be shuffled to change people's places, to move us around so we wouldn't be too close with each other, like friends. But sometimes we could stay for 6 months, and even more, with the same group. The mayor of Kherson, Mikolayenko, was there with us. I must say he is a tough guy. Then there was that American I mentioned, but most of all I remember Pasha, may he rest in peace, the one who hanged himself. That's who I remember most.
Well, we'll talk about him later.
And civilians were also serving sentences, of course.
Many civilians?
There were many civilians.
And why, well, why are they being held? Because there is some understanding that military personnel are exchanged for military personnel. Civilians are almost not even taken out.
The civilians are there as if they are being checked, checking their documents, because they suspect some of them of helping the Ukrainian Defense Forces. One of them was considered to be a gunner, although he was actually an old man. Or there was an old woman and they accused her of something, but she was just an old woman. On their side, the main accusation is like helping the enemy and so on. There was a guy who was sitting with us, I can't remember his last name right now. Shiloh is his last name. He's an agronomist from Kherson.
A farmer.
And he was sitting there, he was saying that Russia came and he had, well, a lot of land. And there was equipment, all sorts of things. Russia came and took everything from him, the equipment and everything they could. He just wondered if they also took the grain, because he had invested a lot of money in it. It was supposed to be the sowing season, and he had invested a lot of money in grain. He said he didn't know if it would work out. Well, he's a civilian.
Well, what did they charge him with?
He was checked, and he's been in prison for 3-4 years now.
Like, the fourth year of just checking him?
Fourth year of investigation.
But they took the equipment?
Yes, they took everything.
Like, it's clear what kind of investigation it is. You know, on the day I witnessed the prisoner exchange, I noticed that our guys who were returning from captivity were very thin. And I talked to them, and a lot of them say that they're, well, it's practically starvation. The food is very bad. They can give you spoiled food and so on. The food was really bad, to put it mildly. How was it for you? What was your usual diet?
Well, a spoonful of porridge. I don't know, maybe less. At first, when they brought us to Pakino, we went without bread for 10 days. They fed us nothing. But water and cubes of potato that had been cut up there, dry as they say, and we ate that for 10 days. Then they gave us bread and it was something incredible. Then they could, you know, like in restaurants there are leftovers. Similarly, the prisoners would throw their leftovers to us after they had eaten. Little by little, things started to get a little better. There were inspections, and when there was an inspection, they were all clean and fluffy, and then everything went back to the way it was. And so spoonful by spoonful, it was normal. When I was captured, I weighed 90 kilograms, and when I was released, I weighed 54 kilograms, if I remember correctly.
So you lost 40% of your weight?
I was extremely thin.
And the others who were with you?
Yes.
Again, is this politics in your opinion, or is it simply because they didn't want to do it? Well, they didn't want it locally.
They are like that, and it's politics. Well, it's both. They didn't want to. We talked among ourselves there too, and for example, some guards would say, "Why should they have to bring food? I don't want to do it." Well, like, they were lazy. Well, like, food was allocated to us. They just didn't want to do it. Others there could also decide that they didn't care and that we would find something to eat ourselves, that's all.
It got to the point where, like, you were already ready to eat anything? I know some cases when someone even ate toilet paper, soap, like, well, it was really tough.
It happened, of course. We ate toothpaste.
What toothpaste?
Toothpaste, named Arbiter. They gave it to us, we put it on our fingers, at least to eat something. Hunger dulls the senses. So that, well, at least for a couple of hours, we drank a lot of water to fill our stomachs. You feel hungry, you go to the toilet, well, or maybe he mixed his food with water. Well, there are so many ways to do it, just to avoid feeling hungry.
Like something to fill my stomach?
Yes, 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 anything.
Please tell us about the moment when you thought, well, that's it, I can't take it anymore, I can't do it anymore. And probably, that's it, this is the end for me. If there was such a moment, of course.
Every person has a moment when they think, that's it, I can't do this anymore. Well, all kinds of thoughts are running through your head and you think it will never end. Never. Because we're already there, we've gotten used to them, and they've gotten used to us. When the new guys arrived, the guards decided that we couldn't be mixed with them, because we had been there for a long time, since 2022, and the new guys were from 2024. They decided that we couldn't be mixed. We were already used to it, but the new guys weren't. The guy sitting next to you might notice that you're spacing out, thinking about something, and you catch yourself thinking that, and then stop. The guys come over anyway, they might put the hand on your back or put their arm around your shoulder to cheer you up. They tell you that they are waiting for you at home and not to give up, and that's it, and then you, yeah, that's it, you're gone. It cheers you up a little, because you understand that they are waiting for you at home, and you have to get out of here. That's what's really kept you going all this time. And they will wait for you, nothing else matters.
Is that a self-affirmation?
Yes, it's a self-affirmation. Yes, impossible. When you decide in your head that you have to go all the way, don't give up, because at any moment, you might lose hope. You have to quickly pull yourself together and move on. I keep having these dreams. Pasha hanged himself. I'm going to have to amputate it.
If you're interested in this story, you can support our project by subscribing to it on Patreon. That's where you'll find the extended version with more shocking content that we can't post on YouTube. Click the link below this podcast.